Today on Vox Talks, 700 years of nepotism. Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Sons often followed their fathers into positions in Europe's pre-industrial universities, but did this hold back scientific progress? Any historian of the era can have an opinion on that, but providing rigorous evidence either way, well, that's clearly impossible. Not impossible, it seems, for David Delacroix of UC Louvain and Marc Gagné of the Norwegian School of Economics. They're the authors of one of the more unusual pieces of economic anthropology we've featured on Vox Talks. It takes in seven centuries of history and it reaches a remarkable conclusion. David, who is also a CEPR fellow, joins me today. Welcome to Vox Talks.
Hello, Tim.
Now, paint a picture for us of academia in the Middle Ages. How might nepotism have held back scientific progress during this time?
So, well, to answer that question, I first need to explain what we mean by nepotism, how we define it. So, to become a university professor, there is a minimum level of skills, of human capital you need to have. Otherwise, you would never be hired. Now, if this minimum level is lower for sons of professors, then we say there is nepotism. It's like favoritism based on blood relationship. We lower the entrance requirement for the sons. And of course, if instead of hiring a weak son, a university could have hired another guy, meeting the more demanding criterion, then it would be better. Having a better guy would be good for research, for teaching, and maybe also for service to society.
And we know for sure at this time that universities were sometimes not meritocratic, that they would hire the weak son.
So our idea is not at all to lower the merits of medieval universities. Those were amazing institutions. Most of them were bottom-up institutions created by the will of the people, I mean either students or professors, masters, and then recognized afterwards by some authority. There was an academic market at that time with a huge mobility of scholars all over Europe, so those were amazing institutions. Now, the presence of those sons in the list of scholars raises the question of nepotism.
And do we assume then that if there is a family dynasty, you can see that the son also was part of that institution? This must be nepotism?
No, not at all. So in fact, when you read the what I can call the qualitative evidence by reading biographies, you see two features. So biographers, they often write that the father was the first teacher of his son, showing him, for example, the beauty of mathematics or teaching him Hebrew or medicine. This is the human capital transmission part of the story. So the sons could be there because they learned from their father. They maybe got the taste to do that kind of job. But then sometimes you also read anecdotes telling that a certain old professor accepted to retire only under the condition that he would be replaced by his son. And there we might suspect nepotism.
So assuming that we can compile all this data across 700 years, we'll get to that, on the persistence of families in academia, you still have to disentangle this inherited human capital from nepotism. How are we going to do that?
The idea to separate the two, what we call the identification strategy, is the following. So for the first part, the inherited human capital channel, essentially we do like other people do. We need to correlate some observed outcome between the father and the son. Mm-hmm. Between each father and his son. And so observed outcomes, we will use publications. And those publications, they are measured for each person in the database using the catalog of the libraries belonging to the global WorldCat system, where you can find how many books were written by that guy. So now to identify nepotism, so that's the other channel. In fact, we need to compare, in a sense, the average son to the average fathers. Or I should say we should compare all sons in general to all fathers. And if those sons in general are worse enough, then this will indicate nepotism. So in fact, it's a bit more complicated than that, because first we need to take into account that publications are a noisy proxy for human capital, so it's not perfect. And then there is also a natural tendency of a reversal to the mean. So I mean, when you are the son of a very famous guy, like Leonhard Euler, for example, the great mathematician, it will not be easy to beat him, to be better than him. And so all those features are embedded in a structural model, and we can identify the parameters of this structural model by matching those features from the data. So father-son correlations, and then average son versus average father.
Now, you need to compile 7 centuries of data. Did you have to make your own data set? Because I can imagine that taking 7 centuries.
Yes, in fact, the question of nepotism here came from my more global project on academia before the Industrial Revolution. I'm building a huge database of all scholars who intervened in universities and scientific academies in Europe before 1800. And so when you build such a base, going through a list of professors or through biographical dictionaries, you realize at some point they are fathers and sons. You see them. So to give an idea about the magnitude of so far, this morning I have 44,000 scholars in my base, and there I have 1,400 persons having a son who was hired in the same institution as him. So to gather these 44,000 scholars, so far I've worked for 3 years with the help of some students to encode the data. We are lucky in Louvain to have very good students who can read Latin, Italian, German, even Russian. Mm. Now the data collection is not finished, and I just received some support from the European Research Council through an advanced grant, and I hope maybe to double the amount of information I have while exploiting the data in new papers.
Now, using this method and the efforts of yourselves and your students as well, how many scholars did you find out had their position through nepotism? How much did this hold back the course of science?
We find that about 16% of scholar sons achieved their position because of nepotism. For every individual, in fact, we could even give a probability that this would be nepotism. And so this held output in terms of publication back by 20%. So I told you the data will continue to expand in the coming years, but I think the results are very stable now. They do not change when we add more information, but adding new data will narrow the uncertainty surrounding these estimates.
Gosh, there are 2 periods as well that you single out as different from this. Which periods are these?
Yes, we compare nepotism in 3 different periods. So first, before the scientific revolution, then during the scientific revolution, and then during the Enlightenment. So roughly, the scientific revolution, it goes from Copernicus to Newton. So it's when a new way of thinking took place and modern science was initiated. While the Enlightenment, so that's the 18th century, it's more on the political and legal spheres. There has been a lot of research in economics on the Industrial Revolution, and much less on the Scientific Revolution and the Enlightenment. Still, I think those are the 2 key revolutions which paved the way to what would happen next.
And in these 2 periods, do we know that there was less nepotism?
So we estimate that before the scientific revolution, the share of nepotic sons was 45%. Then it went down to 15% during the scientific revolution and only 2% during the Enlightenment.
2%, gosh. And why during these times was there less nepotism? Because it wouldn't naturally happen, surely.
So we try to investigate this question by looking at heterogeneity in the result. For example, by comparing old universities with new universities. And there you realize that the decrease in nepotism, it's not that the old universities suddenly became more virtuous. It's because the new universities, the newly founded universities, and also scientific academies were less prone to nepotism than the older institutions. So that's one point. And then also we can look at Protestant versus Catholic institutions. And we also find that Protestant institutions are less nepotic than Catholic ones. And that goes in the same direction as what I just said.
Your institution, David. I looked it up. It was founded in 1425, so that's about halfway through the period that you look at, because I think you start in the 11th century, the end of the 11th century. How good is Louvain's record in this respect?
So in Louvain, I spotted 9 father-sons pairs, and this was mostly in medicine at the end of the Middle Ages. That's one example, so I cannot say much. So of course, Louvain was and stayed a Catholic university, so the big theology faculty full of priests was not in theory subject to nepotism, at least the father-sons sense, because Catholic priests cannot marry and have children. Well, in fact, it's interesting to notice that in Protestant universities, the theologians very often had sons who also became theologian afterwards.
Marx institution, that's a lot newer. It's a modern institution. So should he be worried about the impact of nepotism on research today in universities?
On research in universities, I don't know, perhaps not so much, but I would like to stress a very important thing is that the methodology we have developed in this historical context, in fact, has much broader applications and could be used in many other contexts to disentangle nepotism from skill transmission in many fields, such as maybe politicians, doctors, even entrepreneurs. So it has broad implications, I think.
That's going to be very interesting. Well, I look forward to seeing more of this research, and I'm sure that there's a long way to go with it yet. So, David, thank you.
Thanks, Tim.
Paper we've been talking about. It is called Nepotism versus Intergenerational Transmission of Human Capital in Academia, 1088 to 1800. And the authors are David Delacroix and Marc Gogny. It's a discussion paper 15159 at the CEPR if you want to look it up like that. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. Every week, sometimes twice in a week, we bring you the most innovative economic research. So subscribe to Vox Talks, you'll never miss an episode. And it's great to see so many of you subscribing these days, so thank you very much. And remember, you can find more than 10 years of Vox Talks at voxeu.org/vox-talks.